everybody. It's 6 past the hour, and this is Indirect Democracy. This week on Indirect Democracy, we'll be taking a look at the new terminology of civil war for Iraq. We're talking about Michael Richards, though I truly don't want to. We'll also have the global warming update, the president's horoscope. We'll be having a new word from a new sponsor, and the What a Weenie Award. You know, I never know if I really want to interrupt this song because I enjoy it so much, but welcome. Welcome to podcast number 14 of Indirect Democracy, found at www.indirectdemocracy.com. I am your host. My name is David, and I am a proud member of the Progressive Podcast Network. And if you are listening from that network or found this podcast through that network, I thank you and welcome you. And I also welcome you if you are listening to this through WIRN, the World Internet Radio Network. Thank you for listening through there. So welcome to Indirect Democracy. I'm glad you could join me. It's been a heck of a week. Got a lot to talk about this week. Going to try to keep it short, but there is much, much to cover this week. And as always, every podcast begins with the global warming update, a news story about global warming that in some way, shape, or form affects our lives. As we all know, global warming does affect everybody, but we don't take the time to realize how much so. So here is a news story dealing with global warming. And it is entitled from the New York Times. And I got this one actually off of the update that I get to Indirect Democracy from the New York Times every day, every other day. The New York Times, I have an update feed from the New York Times to the website for Indirect Democracy. Usually I don't like to read those news stories because I figure you can find that for yourself and read it and get updated. But this one was just one that I felt I had to read. And the story is called Changing Climate is Forcing World Cup Organizers to Adapt. This is from Aspen, Colorado. High temperatures in Europe have disrupted the Alpine Skiing World Cup, throwing the calendar of the sport's premier circuit into disarray and raising questions about the future of a sport so vulnerable to climate change. And here's a quote from Atle Scardell. It will very quickly be a big crisis for us if we continue canceling races in December. I think it's very critical, not only for racing, but for public skiing, which also has a big impact on racing. We all have to hope for colder temperatures and snowfall in Europe. Things are much worse in Europe. On Saturday, race organizers in St. Moritz, Switzerland, canceled World Cup races scheduled for December 9th through 10th, saying temperatures were too high for them to make artificial snow. Men's races scheduled for that weekend in Val d'Isère, France, are in peril too, and the International Ski Federation, which runs the World Cup, will make a decision about that race Wednesday. I talked to a lot of people there to get a lot of opinions, and there's a very small chance they can work it out, Scardell said. Some spots on the hill are almost green, but others are close to finished. Now, I bring this story up because even though it seems silly because maybe you're not into sports, but a lot of people are, and a lot of people love to take that time to go skiing. And if you cannot even take that time and your recreation or the things that you love are being affected by climate change, well, then there's a good reason to make some changes in your life. Little things that I talk about every week, just take those moments out of your life to bring about small local changes for yourself that you can spread out. And as I say, the things that we can do locally can affect globally. And let's take the time to get involved because this is a big matter and we do have to get involved. And speaking of things that got involved, today being November the 29th, the Supreme Court heard the case of Massachusetts versus the EPA, and it is a case involving the states requesting that the EPA follow its emissions guidelines as to qualifying carbon dioxide gases or emissions or CO2 gases, which are the leading contributor to greenhouse gases, be qualified as a pollutant for new cars and trucks. Now, that case was heard in the Supreme Court today, and although I do not have the oral arguments ready, as soon as I have them, I will update you with them, and that'll probably be next week's main topic for Indirect Democracy. So I really do encourage you to tune in next week. Hopefully it'll be an interesting topic. I promise not to make it too boring, and I hope that you'll be there. Now, usually after I do the global warming updates, I like to do the president's horoscope, and I will do the president's horoscope, but not without reading this email that I received on Tuesday, the 28th of November. And this is actually from someone I know is a registered fan of the podcast for Indirect Democracy. So to Lala, I say hello and thank you. But I had to read this because it just got me giggling inside. And I'm going to cut through some of the chase. That she was really infuriated by some of the things I brought up in the last topic. She couldn't get over some of the things that were mentioned, especially about the no-fly list. But here's the quote that I really liked. And I'm going to read the whole thing to you because it just really got to me. But the most infuriating part of your podcast, I have to breathe, I was so upset. Sigh. Don't put up those Christmas decorations too quickly, take some time to enjoy. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Putting up the decorations is part of enjoying the holidays. Don't push your stooge propaganda on me, Buster. And I know she means Scrooge, so I know what she meant. Just because you don't like Christmas or the holidays, Christmas hater. I myself have not put up a tree, but we have decorated the house and I love it. It reminds me daily of the season where I think and plan for others. I want to bake cookies, make Christmas bread, the holiday brunch we're planning for this Sunday for family and others. Oh, and friends. Don't put up those decorations? I can't believe you said that! And there's a huge amount of exclamation marks. Enjoying the time is part of enjoying the sight of decorated houses and yards and Christmas trees peeking through curtains of the living room windows. Don't put up those decorations? How about you don't push your agenda on me, Buster? Don't put up those decorations? How about don't be such a Christmas holiday hater, holiday hater? That's what you are, not so indirect holiday hater. How about you enjoy the time? And then I think there was some PPSs here and PSs. My favorite being, we've had our Christmas lights on our house since November 15th. Take a Tums with that one. I love that. That just got me giggling. You know, some of my cousins have had their Christmas decorations up from before November 15th, but that's just because they're lazy and didn't take them down from last year. And thank God they don't live in a place where they have a homeowners association, because I'm pretty sure they would have been forced to take down those lights. I'm going to get back to that email in a second, but I also have to mention this. I'm pretty sure we've all heard about this. A woman who was facing a fine from her homeowners association for putting up a Christmas wreath in the shape of a peace sign. She was requested to put it down because it was considered divisive, and apparently some of the people, and I cannot believe this, thought it was a satanic symbol. It's a peace symbol. It's depending on how you want to believe it. It's always been that since recognized in the 60s, and I believe it's actually the footprint of a dove, if I remember correctly, of what people consider to be. But I always get a little bit interested in what happens at Christmas because of the so-called war on Christmas, and if there is a war on Christmas by the so-called left, and the left has been getting its ass kicked on a daily basis by this so-called war. Myself, I am not saying to not enjoy the time and to not decorate. I guess what I was saying was that when it's Thanksgiving, it's Thanksgiving. Enjoy that time with each other. I just find lately that it is so marketed on us to go shopping, put up those decorations, get them done before the other guy, and not only get them done before the other guy, but make sure that they're better than your neighbors. It becomes a competition. When that becomes a competition, you lose the meaning of the season. I actually prefer it when people say Merry Christmas to me, because it is what the season's about. It's Christmas. If you choose to say Happy Holidays to others, then that's what you say to others. That doesn't bother me at all. In fact, it doesn't bother me how you express it. It's the time of the season, and we enjoy it. But I found it actually kind of funny as to this email, and so Lala knows and everybody knows. I'm hoping to keep this episode short. It may not be as short as I'd like it to be, but I'm hoping to keep this one just a little bit shorter because next week I will be putting out two podcasts, one that will be news and topic-oriented, similar to the format you're listening to now, and I will also put out a special Christmas message, and I'm going to put it out within the first week of Christmas. I'm going to leave it up until about Christmas. And then once the season's done, I'm taking down that episode, which means December 26th, it's gone. So I will have two podcasts going up next week. And so, Lala, if you're listening, Merry Christmas, enjoy, decorate. But I just want people to enjoy the seasons as they come to them and enjoy them on their own time and not according to the time that Walmart says to enjoy them. And that's all I really meant to say. And I didn't get that across last time, but I'm pretty sure we all understand what I mean now. as it's this time of the podcast to give some advice as to what's going on in the world and to help out our president, I like to give out what I call, actually what is called, the president's horoscope. Now, this is meant to give the president some hope and advice through this time of year, which I know is tough for everybody, but it's also tough for our president because he's going through a tough political battle. But here is the president's horoscope, and as we know, our president is a Cancer. So here is the president's horoscope for the week of November 27th through December 3rd. His career meter reading from the pages of Elle magazine is an 8. If you're risk-averse and have a queasy feeling about a debt, settlement, or contract, don't agree to anything this week. Continue investigating all the possible repercussions of an affiliation with a project or group. Huh. Does that mean Halliburton or the Saudis? I'm not sure. Oh, okay, back to the thing. This week is far better for preparation than action. Oh, he doesn't do that! If you're firmly convinced that a situation is right for you, you may decide to move forward with it later this week, but may still have lingering questions over the weekend. Unless you're on an impossible deadline, wait until next week. He is on an impossible deadline. The 109th Congress is probably about to go on recess for the Christmas vacation, so he is on an impossible deadline. Oh, and Mr. President, this week's touchstones are Mandarin Garnet. Yeah, Mandarin Garnet and Black Opal. It doesn't take them very long for them to find me a touchstone I've never heard of. Good horoscope. Hopefully it is helpful to him. And hopefully this will be helpful to you. It is an advertisement from the Progressive Podcast Network.
In a world of insanity, one man can help you make sense of it all.
It's time for America to pull their heads out of their asses and understand what's really happening in this country.
The Rampage Podcast.
I'm Dan Royer, host of the Rampage Podcast. My mission is to keep free speech free and expose the truth about American politics. Join me 5 days a week for never-ending truth that you're not going to hear in the corporate media. Look, if you're sick of a Congress that is overspending yet underfunding, an administration that is overstepping the bounds of the Constitution and underestimating the intelligence of the American people, then you'll learn a thing or two from the Rampage Podcast. Visit the show at www.therampagepodcast.com. I promise to keep free speech free on the Rampage Podcast.
Once again, that is a wonderful podcast brought to you through the Progressive Podcast Network, and I encourage you to visit their sites, visit their forums at progressivepodcastnetwork.org, and the forums which you can go to, which are great forums to get involved with all different types of topics, at newmediarevolutionaries.com. The links for those sites, of course, up at the homepage for Indirect Democracy. You can't miss it. It's right there under the logo for the Progressive Podcast Network. Really proud to be a member of them. In fact, I finally got my T-shirt today, so I plan to wear that like super progressive every now and then. Just open up the shirt, give a little glimpse, let people know that super progressive lives in Orange County. That ought to freak out some of the people in this area, all those conservatives. And this week, I actually got to hear a really great piece by Richard Dreyfuss when he was on the panel for Real Time with Bill Maher. And just loved it. It was a great little dissertation. I use the word dissertation, I guess, too much. But it's a great explanation about the importance of civics in American society. And I believe he's involved with a panel regarding civics for Yale University. I hope I have that correct. I just really enjoyed it. I'm going to share it with you in just a bit. I might also share with you. What was originally going to be the intent of Indirect Democracy, which was going to be a little bit of a civics lesson, a little bit of a political history lesson with people. But I just sort of felt that that might get a little bit boring. And because I knew every now and then my nephews would hear some of these podcasts, you know, I didn't want to bore them as well. And I felt it was important to share the importance of local governments and national affairs, because it does affect us all, by talking about issues as they came, different topics, and that's why I changed what would be the concept of indirect democracy. But when it comes to the importance of American history and politics and civics as a lesson for us all. I don't think anybody could explain the importance of it better than Richard Dreyfuss in this portion from Real Time, and here it is.
That's the constancy that you can learn. You can actually learn the constancy of curiosity and the constancy of outrage. You can learn that it is okay to keep asking the questions and to be dissenters. And if you don't, if you're not taught it, then you don't know it. But we owe ourselves and the United States that we will pass off to our children to relearn the tools of reason, logic, clarity, dissent, civility, and debate. And those things are the nonpartisan basis of democracy, and without them, you can kiss this thing goodbye. And it is up to us. It is up to us. It wasn't because of the conspiracy that this left. It was thoughtlessness. And what you have to do is get it back. And what happens now in this partisan-addicted country of ours is that Democrats are afraid that if they send their kids to civics classes, they might not come back Democrats. And Republicans are afraid their kids won't come back Republicans. But civics, the expertise needed to understand Western Enlightenment and civil liberties, is not something you're born with. You have to learn it. And we teach our kids what we want them to know, and we don't teach them what we don't want them to know. And that's not a conspiracy, that's human nature. And you have to, we have to remember that unless we teach the ideas that make America a miracle in government, a miracle that everyone knows is a miracle, unless we teach what that means, then it will go away in your kid's lifetime. And we will be a fable. We will be a tale told about this place that used to stand up for blah, blah, blah. You have to teach it. You have to find the time and creativity to teach it in school. And if you don't, then you will lose it to fundamentalists of any stripe. You will lose it to stupidity. You will lose it to the darkness. And what this country represents is a tiny twinkle of light in a history of oppression and darkness and cruelty. And if it lasts for more than our lifetime or our kids' lifetime, it is only due to the fact that we put some effort into teaching what it is. The ideas of America, the idea of opportunity, mobility, freedom of thought, freedom of assembly. And if you don't teach it, it'll go away. And in the middle of the night when the towers fall, we will not say, "What am I responsible for?" We will say, "Tell us what to do." And remember, democracy in any form is only 200 or 300 years old. Kingship is 10,000.
No, it goes back to Athens.
No, I mean in practice, in the way we live with each other. In the practice.
Well, they practiced it in ancient Greece.
And then it went away for 2,000 years. And what we've had is monarchy and theocracy and a kind of, God tells the king and the king tells us. And the idea of being personally responsible for your government is a twinkle. It's only as old as, since Victoria's death. And we have to support it or we will else instinctively react as we have for 10,000 years. Tell us what to do. And we'll chuck these liberties the moment the next terrorist horror happens.
Okay. That's well said. I'm glad you were here to say it.
Suffice it to say, I was blown away by those remarks. They capture the spirit of what it is that we try to be every day as Americans in this wonderful experiment that we call the United States. And I've said it before, but the beauty of this country is that it is founded on an idea. Not on nationality, not on some nationalistic stance, not on the color of our skin or the language that we choose. It is founded on an idea of who we want to be and what we truly believe in, which is the rule of law. That concept that we follow and live by a set of rules established in the United States Constitution. And recently, that Constitution has found new breath and new life, and it always has breath and life, and it changes, and it adapts, and it grows, and I always have believed and continue to believe that it is a living document. Because every day that we live in this society, that we interact with each other, the Constitution is involved. This, what you are listening to right now, is an example of our First Amendment rights in action. And it is a wonderful, beautiful thing. I am proud of it. Not because it allows me to speak, but because it allows everyone to speak. And that is a wonder for the ages and should be cherished every day. And I'm reminded of it in a bad segue because of what has occurred recently with Michael Richards. Now, I'm not going to defend Michael Richards and what he said. I want to make that clear. I thought it was, at first when I saw it, I thought it was just a very bad act until I saw the portion where he talked about lynching the guy. Anger or not, lynching is the last thing you talk about, and whether or not Michael Richards is a racist is going to be up to him and his maker to try to figure out, and should probably be best left by us to say, you know what, he's done. The second we all saw that tape and heard what happened, we all knew deep down inside that he was done. But of what effect will it be to him? That guy's going to make money hand over fist from Seinfeld, you know, residuals. So whether or not he feels sick inside is going to probably matter little in the long run, because in the end, people will still watch the show. He'll still make money from every time that show is in syndication and from every DVD that's sold. Michael Richards will be fine. The furor of what has been said will be forgotten. We'll remember it slightly, but it'll be forgotten. Personally, I could care less about Michael Richards. You know, the show was fine, I enjoyed it, but as far as he goes, I could have cared less, and I sort of cared less after when, back in January of 2006, this year, my fiancé and I went to a comedy club specifically to see him, because she is a fan. And the man didn't show up. He canceled at the last minute. I'll never forget the woman at the ticket counter who said, "Be glad, his stand-up isn't very good." So I wasn't sad by it, and I wasn't half surprised by what occurred, because I've heard that this was a manic, over-the-edge type of guy, and that the act, you know, at times could be good, but for the most part was crap. That's what it was. I wasn't surprised at when people said he exploded on stage. I was, of course, surprised, like everybody else, what he'd said, because you knew it was a career killer. I bring up this topic because what has occurred recently. Now, I want to make this also very clear. In no way, shape, or form am I espousing the belief that we should use what is called the N-word. I do not use it myself. Doesn't mean that I've never used it. I would be a liar if I said that. Of course I've said it in some way, shape, or form. We all have said it in some way, shape, or form. But this past week, Jesse Jackson and Maxine Waters called for the overall ban of the use of the N-word. It got me thinking about censorship. Even though this is a word whose connotations bring about the most divisive and horrible examples of human depravity and what we stood for, what this country stood for at one time and still continues to stand for in blatant racism, I worry about censorship in this format, the free flow of ideas. And it got me thinking, of course, about a George Carlin stand-up piece called "They're Only Words," which I'm about to share with you.
There's a different group to get pissed off at you in this country for everything you're not supposed to say. Can't say nigger, boogie, jig, jigaboo, skinhead, mooly, moulinon, schwarzer, jungle bunny, greaser, greaseball, dago, guinea, wop, ginzo, kike, zeeb, heeb, yid, mocky, hymie, mick, donkey, turkey, limey, frog, zip, zipperhead, squarehead, kraut, hiney, jerry, hun, slope, slopehead, chink, gook, There is absolutely nothing wrong with any of those words in and of themselves. They're only words. It's the context that counts. It's the user. It's the intention behind the words that makes them good or bad. The words are completely neutral. The words are innocent. I get tired of people talking about bad words and bad language. Bullshit! It's the context that makes them good or bad. The context that makes them good or bad. For instance, you take the word nigger. There is absolutely nothing wrong with the word nigger in and of itself. It's the racist asshole who's using it that you ought to be concerned about. We don't care when Richard Pryor or Eddie Murphy say it. Why? Because we know they're not racist. They're niggers. Context. Context. We don't mind their context because we know they're black. Hey, I know I'm Whitey, the blue-eyed devil, patty o-fade, gray boy, honky motherfucker myself. Don't bother my ass. They're only words. You can't be afraid of words that speak the truth, even if it's an unpleasant truth, like the fact that there's a bigot and a racist in every living room on every street corner in this country.
And isn't that the truth? And that's the truth. That's the type of thing that we have to be worried about. The word will always be there. And it'll always be fuel for people like this guy who called in to the Ed Schultz Show.
Keith in Rochester, New York. You're on the Ed Schultz Show. Thanks for calling.
Let's cut right to the chase here. I'm a very, very conservative white guy, and I'm calling in on behalf of the, thank God, still dominant white culture. All of the cities you've named, Miami, El Paso, Los Angeles, believe me, white guys like me, those have now become foreign entities. You mentioned all of the various white ethnic groups in Fargo. If they were forced to listen to Spanish, I guarantee you there'd be rebellion in liberal Minnesota. We've just had the Canadian government give special nation within a nation status to Quebec. Mr. Schultz, what do you want? The further balkanization of our country? We want it English. We want it white dominated. You're a good guy, you make a lot of sense, but you bully people just like Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity on my side of the aisle. You've got to listen to this. We want America white the way it was. We're not taking any prisoners on this.
Keith, are you a member of the Ku Klux Klan?
No, I'm not. Don't get funny with me. I'm talking to you man-to-man with you here. I'm talking with you man-to-man here.
You brought up the color of skin. You said we want America
there's
white.
There's nothing the matter with that. But we just got through celebrating Thanksgiving in 1621. All of the pilgrims, man and woman, were Caucasian. This is a country. You can factor in slavery, but this culture of ours, this country, all of the founding fathers, white, white, and more white, and there's nothing to apologize for. I don't understand, even though you're very liberal, are you not proud of just simply being a white guy, period?
I don't think that my maker would be maybe calling a talk show saying what you're saying. Not from my faith. I don't judge people by the color of their skin, and I'm sorry to hear that you do.
Well, just so you're so patronizing, just so you know.
How am I patronizing,
Keith? Well, I'm going to stay here. My father is a clergyman, and he and I are diametrically opposite on this. If he were to come into your studio right now with his white collar and black clerics, you'd almost certainly think he was a Roman Catholic priest. He's, in fact, Episcopalian. Even though he doesn't, I'm going to phrase it this way, he hates my guts for the way I think, but I'm telling you in a rational way, good people are pushed to the nth degree when our culture is really at risk. We're really feeling it in this country. We never look at the Michael Richards fiasco. People explode because we've never been given an opportunity to talk openly about race and prejudice in our country. You can say all you want to about me, Keith, personally. Give me at least some guts for getting away from the corporate pressure to shut my white mouth. How many white guys do you know who would come on like this? Oh, it's okay for the color to call us hunkies and crackers, but if we should, N-word this or whatever, because we're white, we're automatically the evil people. Look what happened in New York City there with the firing of the 50 shots. even a white guy like me is probably going to say something went terribly awry there. But look at the behavior that these colored guys get into.
All right, Keith, you weren't bullied. I let you speak your piece, and I totally disagree with what you're saying. And I'm not trying to patronize you, but I'll pray for you, buddy. I don't think you're an American. I really don't, and I think you got some daddy issues.
Well, the one thing I'll agree with about Keith is that he probably is a cock. Caucasian, that is. He left himself wide open for that one. You know, the thing is that that's what it's getting down to. The words that people ask us not to use should be our choices not to use. It should never come from other people to tell us what to not say in this type of context. That's what I worry about in this reference, in this frame of mind that's been brought up by the Michael Richards incident. I don't worry about the words. I worry about guys like Keith. And so should all of you. Because that's where the real hate comes from. The word, as George Carlin says, is neutral. The hate and the context comes from what we teach our kids. And it's time to address that within each other and to not teach that hate to our children and to ourselves. And if we choose not to use a word, it is because we have made that decision for ourselves and not because the government or other people have told us to. And one final thing I have to address to Keith. What you failed to mention is that while this country has been primarily ruled by Caucasians, it was built on the backs of minorities, whether it be slave labor, Chinese labor, or the labor of the indigenous people that were first here. This country owes a debt to the minorities that helped build it. And now, here is another ad from the Progressive Podcast Network.
Hello, this is Euro Satan. After a long day of tormenting, I love to download the Sooner Thought podcast. It keeps me up to date with political news, commentary, and satire, great interviews with authors and newsmakers of the day, and of course, we must not forget the Euro Satan interview, in which Alex and I discuss the lighter side of the darker side of the world. Tune in at soonerthought.libsyn.com or search iTunes for Sooner Thought. Tell them the devil made you do it.
Well, it is time to get into it and talk about it because the sad term is now being used. Civil War. What makes it sad is that it's not now being called a civil war in Iraq or even the words themselves. What makes this all sad is how long it took to finally come to terms with the reality of what is occurring in Iraq. We're all very aware of the terminology that was being used. It was called sectarian violence, which is defined as violence inspired by sectarianism. And, of course, that's between different sects of one particular mode of thought, not necessarily religious. I'm getting this from Wikipedia. And I think it continues to say on, some of the possible inputs for sectarian violence include power struggles, political climate, social climate, cultural climate, economic landscape, etc. But I want you to consider those words along with the words that are used to define a civil war. And this is also from Wikipedia. A civil war is a war in which parties within the same culture, society, or nationality fight for political power or control of an area. Political scientists use two criteria. The warring groups must be from the same country and fighting for control of the political center, control over a separatist state, or to force a major change in policy. The second criterion is that at least 1,000 people must have been killed in total, with at least 100 from each side. In reality, there is little or no difference in those definitions. What we are talking about here in Iraq is the consistent and violent fighting between groups to gain power over each other that occupy or live within their own country. And if you look at the stats, here's what they are. According to iCasualties.org, 1,755 Iraqis died in Iraq this month of November 2006. Reports from various news agencies state that close to 100 Iraqis die on average every day due to this internal fighting. And in fact, according to an article entitled "The Numbers Prove It, Iraq's a Civil War," here are the statistics that argue for the case in using the terminology civil war, and I quote, "I would argue, however, that by one very basic measure, the number of Iraqis killing each other, we've been there a while and that there's no more defining left to be done. Simply compare the grisly statistics in Iraq with figures from other conflicts that have been certified as genuine full-scale civil wars. Then try to argue that this isn't one. It's a difficult case to make." A study published in The Lancet last month, for example, concluded that about 650,000 Iraqis had died by violence since March of 2003. But that report has been widely criticized, so let's take instead the report just issued by the United Nations, which said that 3,709 Iraqis were killed in October. Those figures are based on statistics from the Baghdad morgue and hospitals and other morgues across the country and overwhelmingly reflect killings carried out by Iraqis against Iraqis. Many observers believe that the actual tolls are much higher because the bodies of many of those killed never make it to the hospitals or morgues. But the UN figure, the fourth straight month in which the number is more than 3,000, may be the best estimate we can get. Now take the American Civil War, the tragic conflict that devastated the U.S. from 1861 to 1865. Estimates of those number of soldiers and civilians who died vary widely, but the figure most often cited by historian James M. McPherson, among others, is about 618,000, a toll that exceeds the number of Americans killed in all other wars, from the Revolutionary War through Vietnam, end quote. So those are amazing statistics, because he has just made the argument based on numbers for defining what is going on in Iraq as a civil war. And if we just go back to the statistic that was mentioned in the definition of a civil war of 1,000 deaths, just in October of last month, according to the UN, there have been more than 3,700. Strangely enough, when thinking of the American Civil War, here's what one political expert had to say on the Jim Lehrer NewsHour.
Professor Kagan, one more question about the terminology. I'm just curious because you have written about wars going back a long way. Do these debates, are they common in warfare when we get to a certain point that people start arguing over what to call things?
Well, the best historical example that jumps into my mind is the American Civil War, which I don't remember anybody calling it that during the time. In the South, they referred to it as the war between the states in order to suggest that they were within their rights in breaking away from the other states. And up here in Connecticut, we referred to it as the rebellion of 1861. And it's that sort of thing that has characterized this kind of issue throughout history, I think.
You know, did I miss something? Every day when I see the listings for the History Channel, the shows that are advertised usually are entitled The Civil War. No one ever advertises as The Struggle Between the States. Or nobody goes to rebellion reenactments. They go to Civil War reenactments. They buy DVDs called The Civil War. Because it's a civil war. If this guy doesn't want to own up to it, or doesn't want to own up to what's going on in Iraq as a civil war, at least do that, but don't lie about what happened in this country. For goodness sake, at least be honest about what all this is. And the reason nobody wants to be honest about what this is because the second the administration uses the terminology of civil war, according to Senator John Warner, here's what happens. Quote, "Senator Warner is among the leading Republicans who suggested that Congress would need to reauthorize U.S. troop presence in Iraq if the situation there descended into civil war. While Mr. Bush has said the role of the American military was not to stand between warring sectarian factions." And therein lays the truth of why this terminology is being fought. Once it is called a civil war by this administration, Congress will have to look into the reauthorization of the use of force in Iraq, because it is not the job of our military to take sides in a civil war. But here's the kind of argument you'll hear from Bill O'Reilly, and I'm quoting from his talking points on this issue. And he quotes, first, we're talking about why it is this terminology is being fought. First is Iran. That country is training and arming Shiite killers to cause chaos in Iraq. Iran clearly wants to dominate the world's oil flow, and controlling Iraq would be a major part of that. Okay, Bill, here's problem number one in your argument. The Shiites are the dominant populace in Iraq. They always were. The second Saddam was removed from power and we took control away from the minority Sunni party who brutalized the Shiites, if you didn't think there would not be retribution of any type, you're just naive. Second, because the Sunnis are going to fight to keep any semblance of power, the obviousness of civil war was plain to see if you had just listened to the former words of people in Bush 41's administration who knew what would happen if Saddam was removed from power. Civil war. Also, if you were so preoccupied about Iran gaining power, you would have known that by giving the Shiites control, they would naturally align themselves with Iran, because Iran is itself Shia-controlled, and we gave the Iranians an automatic government ally when their greatest enemy, Saddam Hussein, was toppled from power. O'Reilly goes on to quote, second, Al-Qaeda, which simply wants to do damage to the USA and is using the Sunni fear of the majority Shia to provoke conflict. It is Al-Qaeda doing much of the bombing of Shia sites, and that, of course, leads to murderous revenge. The Sunnis have aligned themselves with Al-Qaeda, feeling they need protection. Okay, let's run the numbers by you, Bill. According to President Bush, the amount of Al-Qaeda fighters equals 7-8% of the fighters in Iraq. If you didn't understand that, take your hands and count to 7 or 8. That's the first 5 fingers on one hand, and maybe 2 of the fingers or 3 of the fingers on the other. You get it? 7-8% of the fighters in Iraq. The experts who have studied the situation all agree that while Al-Qaeda may serve a purpose for some Iraqis who believe the U.S. is an occupying military force, the consensus is in, and it is clear. If there are no U.S. forces in Iraq, that means the Iraqis will have no use and no want of Al-Qaeda, and they will force Al-Qaeda out of Iraq. But Bill goes on to say what the third problem is and why there is this type of conflict going on in Iraq, and he says, third, are organized criminals who are running wild because there is little Iraqi police presence. Well, that's just our own fault, for not only disbanding the army, but for failing to properly train and supply the Iraqi security forces. Bill goes on to conclude, if the Bush administration will not consider dividing the country into 3 autonomous regions, then it must consider allowing the Iraqi military to run the place much like Musharraf runs Pakistan. Yes, that would be brutal, but clearly the Iraqi people are not embracing freedom. So imposing order through a military strongman might be the only way. This is the saddest of all of Bill's arguments. That we lost the precious lives of over 2,700 Americans to topple a strongman, only to need another strongman. You know, I have to ask myself, would someone remind me and remind Bill of the reason why we went to Iraq? You know, I'm truly glad that our media is finally standing up to what is happening in Iraq. NBC, though, was not the first media organization to call this a civil war. The LA Times began using that phrase about a month ago. It's just the only national TV network to go around saying so. And now the New York Times has just picked up the ball. It's important because calling this a civil war is the truth. It's the elephant in the room that the country does not want to hear, but it is time. It's time because this now requires careful debate. Because the peace of the region is at stake, and so are the lives of our fighting men and women. Well, we're going to play an ad now from our newest sponsor. I'm going to now segue slowly away from that topic of the Iraqi Civil War and get into this new topic, because, you know, recently I found out that the president was seeking the help of a self-help guru during these hard times for himself. And coincidentally, our newest sponsor is in the self-esteem business. So here is this newest ad. Feeling low?
Yeah, a little, yeah.
Feeling down?
Not so crisp.
Unsure of who you are?
I'm a uniter, not a divider, I think. Yeah, I just don't know anymore.
Then we have all your answers.
Sup, ese? My name is Maria Luisa Rosana del Fuentes Hernandez, PhD. Check it. The PhD stands for pretty hot. Damn. You want to know what's wrong with you? I'll tell you my new self-help book entitled, Why Are You So Stupid, Stupid? Want to hear some advice? Listen to this.
We've never been state of course.
Ay, cabrón, don't be lying to me. I heard you time and time again. You think I don't listen? You think I'm stupid? Well, guess what? You're being stupid, stupid. Tell the truth for once in your life.
I'm the decider, and I say Donald Rumsfeld stays.
Ay, ay, muy chingón. You're the big shot decider. Well, guess what? All your decisions suck, stupid. You dropped that cholo once you lost looking like a little bitch. Listen to others once in a while, and you don't look so stupid, stupid.
I want to renominate John Bolton as ambassador to the United Nations.
Hey, don't make me get the belt. Nobody likes that guy. Stop hanging around with losers who could only get jobs because of friends they know. That's like my cousin Ramon. He can only get temp jobs because of my tias comadres. He's a loser. Stop hanging out with losers.
Why are you so stupid, stupid? Now available in the self-help section of every major bookstore and soon available in audiobook formats.
Buy my book, stupid.
Iraq is not in a civil war.
Okay, that's it. Where's the belt?
Well, we're going to end off this podcast the way we always do with the What a Weenie Award. And this week's What a Weenie Award goes to the United States Department of Agriculture. The USDA this week issued a report stating that the poor in this country no longer suffer from hunger or are hungry. They suffer from very low food security. Do you hear those words in your head? Very low food security. I can't get over those words. This makes it sound as if there's a rampant scourge of people or magical little elves that sneak up on the poor and take their rich bounty of food right from under them or from their homes. You know, it's almost to say as if, heck, they may not have that problem if they had brings home security. Oh, but wait. They're poor. They can't afford brings. Hell, they may not even have homes. Yet our government makes it sound as if this is a security issue, and as we know, no one can guard our security like this administration. Lest we forget these statistics from our own Census Department. And I quote, after 4 years of consecutative increases, the poverty rate stabilized at 12.6% in 2005, higher than the most recent low of 11.3% in 2000, and lower than the rate in 1959, which was 22.4%. These are stunning numbers that the poverty numbers have only increased over the past 4 years. So just ask yourself, are we better off than we were 4 years ago? But the moment I heard all this, all I could think of, and don't mean to bring up George Carlin too much, it's just all coincidental. The moment I heard all this, all I could think of was George Carlin's rant about euphemisms and euphemistic language. To paraphrase the man, these people are not suffering from a negative cash flow and are no longer viable members of the working class whose age-challenged dependents live in substandard areas of our urban metropolis and are subject to very low food security. They're broke, unemployed, living in a slum with their kids who are hungry. End of story. Sorry to trouble your gilded sensibilities, but last night, or this night, tonight, in our United States, a child is about to go to sleep hungry. He doesn't have a security issue because someone took or is threatening to take his food. He doesn't even have food in the first place. And if they did, they would eat it. So congratulations to our USDA for the use of soft words created by soft people who live soft lives and don't give a crap about the hard times millions of Americans suffer through every day. For the creation of a nauseating phrase used to distract or hide the truth of American suffering, the USDA earns this week's What a Weenie Award. Well, I'd like to thank you all for joining me for this week's episode of Indirect Democracy. Once again, I encourage you to go to the Progressive Podcast Network, join their network, become part of their forum, be involved. I also want to thank the people who are listening through WIRN. I hope you tune in next week. And, of course, I have to list off the clip that was played by George Carlin, which is "There Are Only Words" from the album Parental Advisory. That's the album. Took me a little bit. And mostly, I want to thank Matt Bloodwell and the guys at Megaphone for allowing me to use their song, Not Your Enemy, as the music for this podcast. You can find their music through their websites found at www.megaphonemusic.net or at their MySpace page, which is www.myspace.com/megaphone. You can also find the links for their music at the homepage for Indirect Democracy, and you can buy their album For Crying Out Loud through iTunes. I encourage you to get it. I encourage you to look up and be involved as far as the music for all independent artists. And that'll be it for this week. I thank you for taking time to listen. Be sure to take care of each other, and I will see you next week. Bye for now.
Humbug!